Lokabhayam karaha, causing fear throughout the universe. Translation. After this, semen, the faculty of procreation, and the god who presides over the waters appeared. Next appeared an anus, and then the organs of defecation, and thereupon the god of death, who is feared throughout the universe. Purport. It is understood herewith that the faculty to discharge semen is the cause of death. Therefore, yogis and transcendentalists who want to live for greater spans of life voluntarily restrain themselves from discharging semen. The more one can restrain the discharge of semen, the more one can be aloof from the problem of death. There are many yogis living up to 300 or 700 years by this process. And in the Bhagavatam it is clearly stated that discharging semen is the cause of a horrible death. The more one is addicted to sexual enjoyment, the more susceptible he is to a quick death. So in this chapter, we are finding a description of how the universe is manifesting from the Supreme Lord. It is explained that first, only the Supreme Lord exists. Aham eva sam eva gre nanyanyat sata satparam. Before the creation, there was nothing but me. Only I was existing, the Supreme Lord. Then, from that Supreme Lord, in due course of time, he began to expand himself. And from that expanded form, he expanded again. From the poreholes of his transcendental body, he manifested the unlimited universes that exist. And within these universes, then, he manifested the various elements, and we're seeing that description now, how within the universe he was manifesting a universal form. That universal form was gradually manifesting within the universe, and his body, the functions of his body, little by little became manifest. Yesterday we read how his skin became manifest and hair on the skin became manifest. And today we are reading how the semen is appearing, and next an anus, and then finally also death was manifesting. So all these elements are existing now within the universe. We see that all the animals are having such organs. So we understand that such organs are originating within the Supreme Lord. The forms of the bodies that we are in are all shaped after the form of the transcendental body of the Supreme Lord, and in this case particularly of the universal form. So that is the context in which we are speaking. Then going to the specific topic of the day, where it is said that semen was created, and we also see that next appeared death. And so that is mentioned by Srila Prabhupada. He stresses this point, the connection between discharging semen and death. Or, as Prabhupada says, the more one is addicted to sexual enjoyment, the more susceptible he is to a quick death. And Prabhupada points out that there are yogis who can live up to 300 or 700 years. He said many such yogis. Now, to us in the Western world, that is a shocking statement. Right? I mean, it's like, man, there are many yogis living up from 3 up to 700 years. Where? Right? In India, however, these kind of things are spoken about. And I remember that in Vrindavan, there was this famous yogi who was supposed to have lived 400 years. One Oriya Baba. He came from Orissa, and everyone knew this Oriya Baba is 400 years old, and etc. Now, whether it was true or not, that is another matter, right? That's another matter. Maybe he had just studied history very well, right? Maybe he was a former history student who had become yogi, right? And was showing off. That is possible, I don't deny it. But he did know lots of facts about the past, right? Or maybe he had a colorful imagination, but he did well. He gave a good presentation. He was very wise also, so everyone was convinced he must be 400 years old. So we hardly take this as proof, but the fact remains, it is possible. The yogis, by retaining their saman, are able to retain a very long span of life. That is possible. Somehow or other, it is ironical that sex is related to death, that the two go hand in hand, right? There is a, that is a funny connection there, somewhat awkward thinking about it. These are descriptions of finer universal laws that we commonly may not know about. But Srimad Bhagavatam gives us an intricate description of universal laws. And now we see that according to Srimad Bhagavatam here, there is that intimate connection described between sex and death. So, what to do here? It is impossible to give up sex, and it is also impossible to give up dying. So one could also argue, well, since we have to die anyway, we may as well go for it while we're in this form of life. But here, Prabhupada is also making the statement that, where does he say that? Let me just see that I read it, you know, instead of saying it myself. Quick death, seventh. Somewhere he said horrible death, I thought. Huh? Where? Yeah, I heard it too. Can't find it now. Ah, here, yes. There are many yogis living up to 300 or 700 years by this process, and in the Bhagavatam it is clearly stated that discharging semen is the cause of horrible death. Right? Horrible death. So, why horrible death? Right? Well, we are seeing nowadays so many people. They are in the old people's home and they are sitting there like some sort of variety of vegetable or plant, right? Shaking and drooling and not all the way with it, etc. Right? Pathetic situations, actually. So it is explained, this specifically happens when there is a lot of illicit sex, right? Then in the old age, one has to go through all these things like becoming demented or becoming physically very much disabled. Whereas if one retains semen throughout his life, then even in the old age, one may not have to go through this kind of problems, right? One may maintain his mental sanity and so forth. So, that's why it is said here, horrible death, not just an ordinary one. These laws of material nature are a fact, and they seem to us somewhat harsh, right? How can it be, you know, that there is such a thing? But we should understand that according to Vedic literature, and Srimad Bhagavatam in particular, that sex life is described to be the binding cause to the material world. It is the best material enjoyment. There is no greater material enjoyment. So material enjoyment is opposing spiritual life. This is the reason why in various traditions of the world, in spiritual traditions of the world, celibacy has been promoted. We find it practically everywhere. We find it, of course, in the East, in the Vedic culture. We find it amongst Buddhists. We find it even in amongst Mohammedans. We find it amongst Christians. We find it in the ancient Greek tradition, at the maidens, at the oracle of Delphi, who had to be virgin maidens, right, and follow celibate, otherwise they were not qualified to have their priestly function. In this way, there were so many examples of celibacy coming up in spiritual tradition. And it is a fact. As one is embracing the standard of celibacy, one's life increases in spirituality. It is synonymous. Yes. So it is at the same time not so easy to just give up sex. I mean, it's easier said than done. Therefore, there are all kinds of means to regulate sexual activity. And that is also a form of renunciation. So is it then recommended to that one can, if one feels a strong pressure from sex life, then one can take to household life even while practicing bhakti yoga, right? It is still possible to be a yogi and have some sexual enjoyment in bhakti yoga. It is the only type of yoga where this is possible. Sometimes they look upon our movement as a very fanatic movement, right? Because of this fact that we are speaking about restricting sex life, and they think it's very unnatural. But mind you, it should be noted that there are many varieties of yoga, and that all varieties of yoga are totally demanding abstention from sex life, if you really follow it. Hatha yoga, Raja yoga, any type of yoga, right, requires that one totally gives up sex life, if you really follow it. Not like some sort of sublimated gymnastics, right, as yoga has become, but rather, if we really follow yoga, then in all processes of yoga, no sex at all, except in bhakti yoga. It is the one type of yoga where it is possible to engage in some sex life and still be successful in the yoga. In processes of meditation, no sex life, right? That is all the, in all these traditions, right? We can see so many things are fashionable. Zen meditation, right? No sex life, right? So in Buddhism, in all types of yoga, no sex life. But in bhakti yoga, it is possible. Kamusmi bharatar sabha. Dharma viruddha bhutesu kamusmi bharatar sabha. It is possible based on religious principles. But those religious principles are quite restrictive because they allow sexual activity only once a month for procreation. When we tell this to the interviewer on the TV, they usually like to elaborate on it so that the viewer gets a good look at the animal that is on his screen right now, a Hare Krishna, a total extremist, a freak of nature who has just given up sex. Can you believe it? Don't you ever feel the urge, right? These kind of questions are then being asked. But actual abstention from sex life is immediately making us detached from involvement with the material energy. It makes us detached from the body. When one understands that that we are actually not this body, when we understand that the body is simply made of a substance and that somehow or other we have entered into it, but it is not us, that it is like a machine, yantra rudani mayaya, that we are now situated on this machine of the body, which we are not, and that now we are working through this machine. When the hand picks up an object of the table, it is like a big crane, you know, that with its like its metal arm goes out, whoosh, picks up a big piece of rock and puts it somewhere else. Just like the crane is an extension of the man inside, the body is an extension of the spirit soul inside. And when that is understood, it is said that within the body, the spirit soul is lying in a dormant state. It is said that at that time, the functions of the spirit soul are not fully manifest. The functions of the spirit soul are diminished when existing within the body. And it is said that the normal functions that are ordinarily going on the platform of the soul, like thinking, feeling, and willing, are now taking place on the level of the mind. Right? And this is a limited reflection of the original thinking, feeling, and willing. The thinking, feeling, and willing on the platform of the soul is by far exceeding the thinking, feeling, and willing on the platform of the body. Therefore, those who are transcendentalists and who give up the pushings of the body are immediately becoming free from material entanglement, and it becomes possible to perceive the spiritual platform. Vācha vegam, manasa krodha vegam, jīva vegam, udrapasta vegam, etam vegam, yuvisaheta dhīram, sarvam apimam pitivim sasisyat. The pushings of speech, of the mind, of anger, of the tongue, of the belly and the genitals. These are the pushings of the body. These are all pushing for our attention. The tongue is constantly pushing for our attention. The mind is just dragging us away all the time. All the time our energy goes into that mind. Somehow or other, we are not we're not able to perceive reality as it is because everything is colored by the mind. We are looking at so many things and the mind adds all kinds of flavors and color. Ooh, this looks threatening, scary. This looks like, this place looks like no good, bad vibrations and so many things all added by the mind. Right? So, nothing can be seen as it is in the, as long as one is attached to matter. Attachment to matter means that the mind goes into the things and the things go into the mind. This is the problem. Once the mind has gone into the things, those things stick in the mind. It is like that, that everything in this world is covered by a secret layer of super glue, and once you touch it, you can't get rid of it. Right? You get anything, right? You touch it, and it sticks like anything. And you try and get it off, and it doesn't work. And it's all stuck in the mind. So the mind is like, over the years, you know, got so many things stuck in there. So it's a real messy affair, that mind. You can imagine, with all the things that are stuck in the mind. So therefore, that influences very much our experience of reality. So, therefore, spiritual life means a purification, first of all. in spiritual life, the first thing we accept is that we are not able in the present condition to perceive things as they are, and that we need purification. This is the beginning of spiritual life. So the beginning of spiritual life is that we should stop taking ourselves so serious. That's the very beginning. That my opinion, what I feel, what I see, what I smell. Yes, I can definitely tell you that I desire... No. We must begin to stop taking ourselves serious, because we must see that our desires are colored by all the contamination within our mind. And therefore, we have no business with our desires, our opinions, our perceptions, and all these things. These are not very important, right? But I feel very strong about this. Yes, that's understood, you know. That's all right. You know, in the psychiatric hospital, people are also feeling very strong, you know. They feel very strong. No, but I feel very strong about it. And the nurse comes and put a hand around the shoulder of the patient and says, yes, I understand. Yes, okay. Let us now. It is now time for lunch. Yes, come and sit down at the table. And then someone comes around with a tray with all the pills. And now just take your pills. And yes, it's good for you. And swallow them. Anyway, so this is what's happening in psychiatric hospitals. The point about it is that a person who is mentally in disorder has all kinds of extreme feelings, strong reactions about things that are not at all important, that are not realistic, and that are not at all worth getting all worked up about, right? That is the problem. Constant, strong emotional experiences about nothing. I saw one boy. He was burning his hand with a cigarette, right? And then he said, the devil is in me. I have to burn him out. Burn. Shh. And then he said, see, there's his face. And on the blister, he said, there's his face. And then he would burn again on the blister. Right? Yes. It was heavy. I mean, like, you know, just stop smoking. Right? Whatever you do, stop smoking. Smoking is bad for your health. Right? Right, I mean, obviously, right, it was time to tell him to stop smoking. Yes, smoking can be injurious to your health, and in his case, it was even more than usual. So, it was recommended that whatever he felt, that he would forget about it, right, somehow or other. It was difficult to make him forget. You know, don't worry about the devil. No, but it's inside. I gotta burn it out. It's all right. No, the devil. Right, stop doing that. Stop that. So what do you do? So this example illustrates very clearly. Foolish, strong feelings. Right? Now we think that that person's feelings are very foolish, and definitely he should have been restricted and should tie his hands up, you know, or something like that. You can't let him burn himself like that, right? Everyone would agree, you know, like, yes, tie up his hands, etc. But we do so many ridiculous things too, but, you know, like, we think, no, but these are my feelings. This is my right to express myself. I need this. I must do this. The boy felt exactly the same. Right? So we too are in our present state of consciousness in the same condition of madness. Right? Just another variety. So there is this type of madness which is like individual madness. Right? It's like one individual has his own peculiar type of madness which stands out so much that they call an ambulance and take him away. They're going to take him away. Ha ha. They're going to take him away. And then they lock him up. Right? And then there's other things which, another type of madness which is collective madness. And everyone calls that normal. Right? That's normal. So that's what we are experiencing now. Yes, yes, it's all totally normal. But it's actually collective madness. Everyone is a, they're all lunatics all together, you know. Right? This is the situation, actually. Like I've said many times about this city of Amsterdam, that the best thing we can do about it is change the name sign and call it like a mental hospital, right? The funny farm, right? I would suggest, right? Change the name to... Yeah, that's the Dutch version, but, you know, we are quite international here, so my suggestion is let's call it the funny farm, right? That would really do justice to the place, right? I think people would appreciate it too, and the residents would like it, because they're crazy enough to appreciate something like that, right? So, the solution for all this is purification. So there's a need in material life for purification. So this is the beginning. One must come to this point that one understands, I need purification. This is the beginning of being cured from the madness, right? One must understand, yes, I need to change. I need to work on myself. I have so many experiences. They're impure and I have to conquer them. And only then will I be happy. But as long as I'm caught up, I'm in the present state of thinking, feeling, and willing, I'm caught up in a vicious cycle, or circle, right? A vicious circle. The German word for vicious circle is quite interesting. In German, they call the vicious circle, a circle that keeps on repeating itself, right? They call it a Teufelskreis, yeah? A Teufelskreis, the devil's circle, right? A Teufelskreis. That is an interesting expression, because it is indeed hellish, right? A vicious circle. One is just caught up in suffering, and one is not satisfied, and therefore he does activities which cause again new suffering. Right? And then one is suffering again, and then one is again feeling that I need relief from this suffering, and one again engages in activities, and one is again experiencing more suffering. Just like here in Amsterdam, the party of the year is without a doubt the Queen's Day, and you know, and this is a city of parties as it is, so it's a big party, and without a doubt the Queen's party, you know, every year, everyone's really trying it, trying and trying and trying to get out of the ordinary realm of not being satisfied to the point of like something far out. And it just, every year again is a letdown, didn't work, and so forth. And only creates more difficulties. All the drugs, all the intoxication, all the free sex, etc. You can just statistically wonder how many people got AIDS on Queen's Day. Yeah, you could think about that. How many people had an overdose, you know? I mean, we did see, while we were chanting in the street, every so many times, it was quite awkward. There was a party, right? Big party. The whole city had a party, and everyone crazy. And we were on the bridge chanting Hare Krishna. And then every 20 minutes or so, these ambulances were arriving, driving past with neck-breaking speed through the mass of walking people. I was just wondering, how did they do it, right? And how amazing they didn't knock anybody over. But it was an awkward thing. It kind of felt like strange party, isn't it? It gave me a feeling, something eerie about the party, you know, like just a flying ambulance right through the party. It looked like, what is this party, you know? What are we doing here, you know? And we're having a party, you know. The next one drop, right? What's going on here, right? Some sort of morbid party, right? Indeed, the material parties are kind of morbid. I know that here in between Amsterdam and Harlem, they used to have parties where they'd lock everyone in a room and then open a gas bottle, And then one guy was under control, you know, like just one of us about coming to the point of crashing on the ground. Then close the tap. And everyone was going, in Ruigoort, you know, in Ruigoort. Right. Yeah, it was a little ruig. Ruig means rough, right? A bit on the rough side. Rough parties, right? I've seen so many parties over the years. But the best parties are spiritual parties, because these spiritual parties are uplifting. The whole purpose of it is to have a celebration which purifies the atmosphere, purifies all the people that are there. Everyone comes together for purification. This is the nice thing about Krishna consciousness. In the beginning in Krishna consciousness, at times I would take a little holiday from temple life. Right? So, on one occasion I was in India, and I felt it was my time again to take a holiday from KC. So I decided to do it, but I didn't have any money at the time. So in Delhi, if you don't have money, you wind up in the tourist camp, because it's the cheapest place to stay in the whole city. Especially if you sleep on the grass, which I did. Could sleep for 1 rupee on the grass, and was still kind of within a few walls, so no one would cut my throat while sleeping. So there I was, without any money, and somehow or other waiting for some money to be sent from the West, and I was sitting there. And then there was a whole group of hippies, and they were all playing guitar and this, that, and singing. And this one boy was singing this song that fortunately I have the key to escape reality. And this was the song of the night. You know, everyone was singing it, and they thought it was a great song, and it was all about drugs, right? And I just felt like, yeah, this is a party here. And how different from the party I just came from. I came from the party with the devotees where the aim was purification, right? And the devotees were gathering together at different times, and the center of the party was purification. Let's come together and let's have a wonderful party where we're all going to try and get purified in different ways. And then I saw this other party, and the solution was, everyone said, we've got the solution. Let's just get intoxicated. And I felt horrified. I felt, what kind of solution is this? Sticking your head in the sand, right? Take some drug by which everything looks different, but it hasn't really changed at all. It's still the same old thing, right? Then better purification, so that we can really become liberated from all these things. Yes, okay, but purification and party? Doesn't purification mean walking bare feet in hair shirts, right? Cold, early morning, praying, right? You already said celibacy and other austerities, and doesn't it mean fasting, and doesn't it mean praying all day, and all those kind of things? Well, it can be done in quite a festive way, right? It can be done in a festive way. It means that we are going to worship Krishna. Oh, yes, we are. We'll make a beautiful arrangement for the deities of Krishna on the altar, which are a feast for the eyes. And after that, or before actually, we also make a wonderful offering to the deity, right, of delicious cooked foodstuffs. Then, after that, when the curtains open, there is a beautiful arrangement. The deities are there. Wonderful prasadam is there. It's a festival. And afterwards, we know what's going to come. We are going to get the remnants of whatever the Lord left over. And that in itself is really makes it worthwhile. And before that, there is transcendental dancing, music. So spiritual life does not need to be dry and austere. It is not that austerity is necessarily the first and foremost means of purification, but rather simply glorification and making sacrifice to Krishna is the process for purification. And this is very nice. So in this way, we can get above the bodily platform, above the consciousness where we become obsessed by sex and subsequently caught up in death and so forth. We can come beyond all that to the platform where we are free. Free from... If someone is free from a material desire, like, let's go back to the idea of smoking. Right? There was a time when I was addicted to cigarettes to an extreme point. I was smoking from morning to night, right? And if at night, somehow or other, my cigarettes would run out, you know, the thought of waking up without in the morning was the greatest nightmare. There was absolutely no way of going to sleep without having that first cigarette to wake up with. So what to do, right? Even if it meant walking 2.5 kilometers one way and 2.5 kilometers back to a machine, it was worth it. Right? It was worth it. An hour, in other words, you know, practically. An hour to go there. Okay, let's go. There's no alternative. It's the only thing possible. We have to do it. Right? So, what misery, so then looking back at that, right, and now being totally free from that addiction, it's a relief. It's a relief. Now I don't have that anymore, that anxiety, you know. I don't have that. I don't have that nasty little cuff anymore. I don't have any of those problems anymore, right? Those yellow fingers, everything stinks and smells. I don't have all that anymore, right? It's easy now. Save a lot of money too. So, in this way, now I'm free. So imagine the same thing. If you don't have to, if you don't have to have sex anymore, if you're just not bothered by it anymore, I gotta go, it's like, you know, I gotta, the hormones are pushing me, I gotta do it, it's stronger than me, okay, let's look for something. But if one is actually no longer plagued by the hormones, what a relief, right? So if sex life can be conquered, that is very nice, and that is possible. Right? It is possible. These pushings can all be conquered. Right? When one comes to the spiritual platform and find another level of satisfaction. So this is actually the result of higher taste, of the taste of making service and sacrifice to Krishna. That will satisfy so much that one loses all interest in other things. I'll stop with this. If there are questions or comments, I'll try to answer. Yeah.
I hear when you don't take sex, you get oral energy. Like brahmacharis, I hear in the spinal cord is more strong, but I don't know in the woman what.
What is possible to get this energy? Yeah, the ojas is like... it is said that in the Ayurveda, there's a description how the energy of digestion is being is going through different stages, right? And if the digestion is taking place very nicely, then you form the finest state of transformation and you get an energy called ojas. This ojas energy is like a type of refined type of air which is circulating within the body, and this gives us a tremendous amount of energy and an effulgence. And if the ojas is plentiful in the body, then we are beaming with health, right? And if the ojas goes down in the body, then we become more and more dull, right? And sickly. We have no resistance, and very easily we become affected like that. So that's what you're referring to, the ojas, right? So that ojas, it says, can go up the spine, right? If in the case one is celibate for life, and then it can give, the ojas can then give tremendous intelligence, right? And then one can better understand spiritual subject matter. So in this way, that's another benefit of celibacy. So what happens in the case of women? It is not really described whether the ojas also goes up the spine or not. I have not read it anywhere. But there is no doubt that the ojas will be retained within the body, right? So through celibacy, also for women, the ojas will remain in the body, and therefore one becomes full of vitality and full of power. That part, whether it goes up the spine, whether that works women, I have not read it. I cannot say for sure. I have not found it. Have you read anything like that? That women are also, that the ojas goes up the spine also? Have you ever read anything anywhere? No, he's read a lot. He probably...
I once read a page from an Ayurvedic book that is sold in Bangladesh, and there it is said that sex life is good for you. It's a little bit strange.
I read
the issue by NB for the first quarter.
Sorry.
I read it for NB for the first quarter of our lives that we indulge in these things.
Yeah, I mean, it is like, both of your statements are interesting. Yours is the first statement, like I read in some Ayurvedic book, which was sold in Radhadesh. No. The only authorized thing about it was Radhadesh. Yeah? Nothing else. So therefore, we must be careful, when we sell books, because by doing that, we are authorizing things, right? So we must be very chaste in terms of the books we sell over the counter. And these Ayurvedic books are certainly not always very good, or many times not bona fide. And so unless we know them, we should not just sell them because it says Ayurveda on the title and we think, oh, well, that's related to KC and therefore it's good money because people are into this and let's sell it from the temple. We should not do that. And as far as point two is concerned, as far as that, like the first 25 years or the first quarter of one's life, yes, it's not the first quarter, it is actually the second quarter. Yeah, so it is the second, because the first quarter of life is, in the Vedic culture, it is said life is divided in four quarters or four sections. Ideally speaking, if life would last 100 years, 25 years of brahmachari or celibate, right, then 25 years in a married position where one can engage in sex life on regulated way, then 25, right, prepare for spiritual life, and 25, taking the renounced order of life. So these four stages are there. Now, however, the second stage is not a requirement. It's not that after the first 25 years you have to engage in sex life. Now, I'm sorry, the first quarter of my life is over. Yep, well, it's today. Yesterday was my birthday, and now I've got to go into the second stage. What can I do? It's like, yeah, I'm obliged, so I've got to start looking today. It says in the scriptures, right? No, it's not like that. Yeah, so it means that if one feels at that stage the agitation of sex life so much, and one is not sufficiently able, due to a restless mind, to apply himself to a spiritual process by which he can conquer that sex life. If the mind is so restless and agitated, all right, then give in to it a bit by doing it in a regulated way. But better, get into a process to conquer the mind and subsequently the senses by which you can remain celibate all throughout. Good, good. Good for you. Very good. Yes. You are. Yes.
You have mentioned celibacy, that the Muslims also have some idea
of. Sufis, yeah. The Sufis. No, no, the Sufis. The Sufis are the... See, there's two paths described in the Quran also. That is explained in, by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Now, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is speaking with this, these Pathan soldiers, right? These Turkish Pathan soldiers that came to Mahaprabhu when he's traveling with a few devotees, etc. And one of them was a prince, and there was also a great mullah, a great scholar. And there was a philosophical discussion, and they discussed the pravriti mark and the nivriti mark within the Quran, right? Or the path of material improvement, right, in life. So pious life, which gives you a better material life. The heavens, and you get so many maidens and all this, right? So, you know, you kill the non-believer and you get 27 maidens in heaven. Things like this. And these kind of benefits are there. It's very interesting. There are, of course, kafirs, right? Those who are the non-believers. Now, there are two types. There is the Ahil Kitab and the Jinnish. The Ahil Kitab are the people of the book. Right? So the people of the book are mentioned in the Quran. Right? And they are Christians and Jews. And they have a right to, they have some rights to exist like in a certain level. Although they are kafirs, non-believers. But they have some right to exist. They must pay tax to the Muslim ruler, and they have a right to exist. Then there's the Jinnish. The Jinnish are not people of the book. They have no rights, and they live only by the mercy of the ruler. Right? So if the ruler lets them live, that's up to him, but they are basically kafirs, non-believers. So they really have no rights. So like the Indians, etc., in that category, Indians, any other religion other than the Jewish or the Christian religion, they are in that category. So they have no rights. Now, later on, the Muslim rule in India was there for 1,000 years. They decided to treat the Indians in the same way as the Ahil Kitab. They made them pay the same tax just for practical purposes. Right, but they do actually do not have the same rights. So, if such a kafir is speaking out against the teachings of the Quran, then it's time for jihad, right? And jihad, then you have to create a mujahideen. Then you have to create a group of warriors who volunteer and who declare jihad upon this person. Now, in jihad, if you declare a jihad upon such a kafir, you can take all his possessions, right? Everything. And you must give 25% to the government, right? But the other 75%, but you can take all his wealth, you can take his wives and daughters, and the sons you can make your slaves, right? So, you know, that is all Quran, right? So it's sometimes quite intense, right, what we're reading there. And this is all part of the pravriti mark. Right? But the nivriti mark is actually the path of ending material existence. So the Sufis are more interested in nivriti mark, right? And they're following principles of celibacy and They are into being vegetarians and so many things, actually, the Sufis. So, any elder?
See, we read that in the Vilata Purusha, the skin appears, the hair, the beard, the hands. So when do they appear?
When?
Where?
Where? Well, there we find another description somewhere in the Bhagavatam, which I do not recall verbatim right now, because I don't have it under my nose, but there it describes that the mountain ranges are like the spine of the Lord, isn't it? And the hairs on the body are described like the trees on the planet, isn't it? Isn't it described like that, if I remember well? So, exactly how all that is working, it remains a little difficult for us to visualize this universal form, but let it be understood as such. So, exactly, if you're going to ask me where then the organs that are described today, like the anus, where the anus of the universal form actually is situated, then I'll have to tell you, I knew you would be tempted to ask that question next. So I'm just asking it for you, right? I'm not sure. Some say it's in Calcutta.
I'd say after just experiencing 3 months there.
He says it's in England. In other words, there are different opinions about that. Any other question? No. Yes.
I find one book in the library. This Kripal Singh.
Kripal Singh.
This book.
Yeah. From the Golden Temple.
There's two books. The one where it's like dangers of mystic power.
Yeah.
Occult and spiritual healing.
Yeah. Dangers of mystic power. You want to ask me what the dangers are of mystic power. The greatest danger of mystic power is that it can divert the person who has mystic power from the spiritual path. In fact, it is described in the Chaitanya Charitamrita that these mystic powers, they obsess one. There is that famous analogy about the astrologer Sarvagya, and you have to help me a little bit. Was it that in the north there was this black snake, I think, and in the west there was this ghost? That was, yeah, it's the north, the black snake. So it's the black snake. Okay, so the black snake, it is described that there was a treasure right hidden. The astrologer said to the poor man, "Your father died in a foreign land, and you thought you were poor all along, but he left a great treasure, but he couldn't tell you because he died prematurely. Now you go looking. If you go looking in the north, you will find a big black snake which will devour you." So going to the north meant going to the Himalayas, where the yogis are trying to get mystic perfections. So it's talking about getting mystic perfections, and the black snake means you become devoured by it. So the greatest danger of mystic power is that it devours the one who uses it, and that it actually totally obsesses him and takes over all his energy. Everything goes there for having the mystic power, and he loses his interest in the Supreme Lord. So he kills his spiritual life with it. That's the greatest danger. And there are other smaller dangers, so many dangers, right? You may invoke something and you may not be able to control it. You may use a mystic weapon on someone, but that person may have power to counteract it, and then that mystic weapon has to destroy. And if it cannot destroy anything, then it will destroy the one who generated the weapon at first. So then it will destroy the one who sent it. So many dangers involved in various mystic powers. Right. So there are mystic powers coming forth of the mode of goodness, coming forth of the mode of passion, coming forth of the mode of ignorance. So accordingly, or we could say white magic, black magic, right? So obviously the black magic is, or the mystic power coming from the mode of ignorance is more dangerous than the white. But even the white is dangerous. Right? Even that one can misuse. Is in the mode of goodness, mystic powers coming from the mode of goodness. Right? So not coming from some tantric ritual and not being used for destruction, etc. Not being used to get rid of this enemy. I mean, you have these things. If you know a place where someone passed urine, you take some earth from that place, and then you have to get some of his fingernails and some of his hair. You mix it all and you cook it well together with a lizard that you have boiled for 7 days, and the whole thing is to be done at the full moon, and then you boil it down until a thick paste is coming. You grind that paste to a powder. You throw that powder on the head of that person, and he's crazy forever. It's right there in the tantric literatures, such kind of things. So this is a mode of ignorance. So the mode of goodness, or the is where the mystic powers are there for upliftment. They are used to, at least they are used for aiming to benedict people, to help people, right? To help other living beings. But real help is only spiritual help, right? So even with mystic powers, all help falls short, right? Even if you can fly in the sky with a cape, you know, flapping in the air, and save the car going over the cliff, right? Carry it back onto the road. It's not good enough.
So how can we seriously take information from this book, like from this?
We cannot. No. We should take it out of the library and throw it in the garbage can. That should not be in the library. Sometimes some books slip in, you know, here and there. There's so many books around. So they jump on the shelf, take them out, throw them in the garbage can. Books from karmis, depends what kind of book it is. Every book has to be judged individually. There are some books by non-devotees, one should consider them boga, right? And if they can be offered to Krishna, right, somehow or other, we should look at them and see if they're offerable. And then we should use them in the service of Krishna. So there are many books you can use in the service of Krishna. Like, you know, like for example, if you're into theater, you know, like, I mean, there are books about acting, right? And they're very good. I mean, they're super good books about acting. So what's, when one wants to act for Krishna, what's wrong about having a book about acting? Or let's say a book about Sanskrit drama, right? One wants to know everything about Sanskrit drama, but no devotee has written anything about Sanskrit drama. You can buy such a book. It's a great book. Right? Or you want to know something about philosophy and you buy a dictionary of philosophy. Boy, is it good. Right? Or you want to know what philosophers think. So you have like a few philosophy books. So it's all right. But, you know, one must... It is boga, and it must be offered to Krishna. Otherwise, it's useless. Yes, Prabhu.
I was listening to a lecture, and then one girl asked Bhagavad, is there any description of Shanadar?
Ah, yeah, that one.
In the Bhagavatam. And Bhagavad said, what do you mean? Well, there's similar stories like that. He says, any Jindar, any more or less like anything which directs towards pure devotional service is Bhagavatam.
Yes.
So in this way we can anything which inspires you. Who is inspired? inspire the person who wrote it to become a pure devotee of the Lord, either if it's in a Christian or Muslim way, then that is completely bona fide.
It maybe goes to use the Jajan Dark example to say that everything is Bhagavatam. I'm not sure if that's really true. I remember the lecture also, but I thought that he said there that the way I remember the conversation, it's like this. The girl's asking Joan of Arc because she's American. So she says, is Joan of Arc also in the Bhagavatam? And Prabhupada says, eh? You want to see Joan of Arc in the Bhagavatam? And then he thinks for a moment, he says, yes, she's also in the Bhagavatam. Right? Because because the life of every devotee, of every, is Bhagavatam. Right? I thought it was like that. I didn't think that it was like, if you take like a book about, even if it's Vedic architecture, right? That's Bhagavatam. Vastu Shastra is not Bhagavatam.
He was saying that Bhagavat is supreme.
Yeah.
Anything which has to do with devotional service to God.
Yeah.
That is about, if it's about God.
If it's about,
it's,
yes.
Kind of,
yeah.
It's not that it's Srimad Bhagavatam.
No.
But that's about the Lord.
Because the person Bhagavat is also Bhagavatam.
Yeah.
Like that.
Because I listened to it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's okay. So I also like that one. It's a very nice point. It's really interesting. I use it sometimes, the story.
The devotees, you hear, you feel that the devotees come, they chuckle or something like that. And then Papa says something completely different.
Right.
You feel, at least I feel the tape, the devotees going like, huh?
yeah, of course. Of course.
So realize that he's completely, that they never thought of like that.
No. Right. It's very true. Anyway, so we're not fanatics, you know, about other books, etc. I mean, but we must be careful. And like I've said that sometimes, filters on, right, with other books. We have filters on. Right? If you like filters, you have to get from Prabhupada's books first. And then if you have filters that you got from Prabhupada's books by reading them very thorough, and you know all the standards according to Prabhupada's books, then when you read these other books, you find, hey, this doesn't rhyme with what Prabhupada says. Okay, filter it out. This also. Like we're reading Mahabharata, and there Lord Krishna is described as the seventh avatar of Vishnu. Filter it out. Right, things like that. You need filters. Otherwise, if we don't have our filters first, then we're going to get lost in these books. They're going to contaminate us. And even if we have filters, if we read too much of that, we may still get contaminated. Something slips through the filters. So it's not recommended to just spend too much time reading all kinds of outside books. But sometimes specific ones about a field of knowledge. Right? If you go and preach to biologists, then it is useful to read something about their ideas, and then you can relate our philosophy to their ideas, and then you can present it in their language, you know, which is useful.
And they read some other books. And I remember Harikesh gave instruction to the disciple to read three times all Prabhupada books. And then to read some other books.
Well, that's the point about the filters, you know.
He said you have to read now five times all Prabhupada books, and then read other books.
Okay. The number three times has some traditional value, because three times was the it was said that you've completed your Vedic studies after you've read the books three times. That was the traditional standard. You had to read all the Vedic literatures three times, and then you had completed your study. So three times especially is a traditional thing. Then five times, okay, you know, because he saw the extra danger of Kali Yuga. Kali Yuga. Five times. Whether it is a fixed number of times, right, it means that we must thoroughly absorb Prabhupada's books before we go into reading other books. And even then, my recommendation is this, you know, I have a simple analogy, which is, and I've said it before also here in Amsterdam, but that you have rice, dal, sabji, chapatis. So our rice, dal, sabji, chapati is Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, Nectar of Devotion, Chaitanya Charitamrita. And then you want some chutney with your meal, right? Okay, read a little something else, you know, a little chutney, right? It's chutney. But if you eat only chutney, right, and you hardly take anything, rice, dal, sabji, and chapatis, you're going to get unhealthy after some time. Right? You can't live on chutney alone. Right? So this is the point. When devotees start living on chutney alone, and they stop regularly taking a good, healthy diet of rice, dal, sabji, chapatis, of these basic four books, then they begin to develop spiritual misconceptions. Finished. Thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. It's always like that when you start talking about prasadam, then you know it's time to stop.